you understand the techniques and philosophy which we would like to apply also to higher dimensional quantum gravity. So in general for higher dimensional gravity, I would say that the philosophy of this approach, which I will present here, is to appeal to asymptotic safety. And I guess that, Martin has described this in detail for you, the philosophy behind this, which were maybe first well introduced in this context of gravity by Weinberg. But I mean, this is the underlying idea here is simply that there exists some kind of non-trivial fixed point which can be described by ordinary field theoretical measures, and which describes quantum gravity. And what we are attempting here is a kind of lattice realization of this theory, finding this fixed point and investigating the physics associated with it. That's what we are aiming for. Maybe I should reveal for you my general feeling about this, maybe before I start, then you can leave the room. but I mean, we don't know, of course, whether there exists a higher dimensional theory of quantum gravity. I mean, one can hope or not hope, depending on one's attitude, that there exists such a theory. But there are, of course, other candidates for describing quantum gravity as an effective theory, in particular, of course, string theory. And string theories, which of course, claim that we are wasting our time thinking about alternatives to string theory. They might be right, because we don't know whether there exists a higher dimensional theory of quantum gravity. Four-dimensional K-theory. On the other hand, I think one should also, without being an anti-string person, one should also say that in a certain way, it's quite limited what string theory has contributed to our understanding of physics at the Planck scale. And since they really maybe haven't delivered, I think it's only fair to also try alternative attempts to describe this. And this asymptotic safety idea that is a non-trivial fixed point, which can be described by ordinary field theory, is kind of an attempt. It kind of definitely lacks the beauty of, say, string theory, which unifies all kind of forces, all particles, etc. But on the other hand, I mean, we don't know what is right. We don't know whether string theory is right. We don't know anything. So this is basically experimental physics, you could say, carried out by a theorist. And in particular, when it comes to the computer, we will get very close to experimental physics because we are just simulating and trying to understand what the data will tell us. But when we are in lower dimensions, we can actually do analytical calculations. And it is what I will start describing for you here. So the plan of these lectures is as follows. I will start with this very simplest system that we can imagine, which fits perfectly into this context here. This is kind of one-dynamical dynamical triangulations, I call it here. It is just the quantization of the free particle. But I will spend some time here because this example contains everything that we need. Once one has understood this, what we are saying here is kind of trivial, a trivial generalization. So I'll move to the two-dimensional case. So two-dimensional case, that means non-critical strings or two-dimensional Euclidean quantum gravity. And I will give you the combinatorial formulation of this in terms of how you can make a lattice, build up a lattice of space-time by purely combinatorial methods. And I will describe how it's realized as a matrix model. Then I will describe how you take the continuum limit of this series in the same way as you try to take the continuum limit of a lattice field theory. Then you can try to take the continuum limit here. And one of the main motivations, of course, for using, say, lattice gate theories to understand the physics of hadrons is that we have no really powerful non-perturbative tools available. So we use the lattice as a non-perturbative definition of this theory, and in the same way, we have this formulation here. And when we use a matrix model, it is possible to think about the matrix model as a non-perturbative regularization of this two-dimensional quantum gravity. And I will describe a number of aspects associated with this, the so-called non-perturbative physics we can extract from matrix models, and kind of whether this is physics or not. Because it turns out when we deal with these matrix models and try to describe non-perturbative aspects of them, we are facing the same problem as with our ordinary lattice gauge theory, for instance, that some of this physics, which is kind of non-perturbative, might be lattice artifacts. And in the same way, some of this physics might be matrix model artifacts, which has nothing to do with quantum gravity. So I'll discuss various aspects of this. Then I'll turn to one of my favorite topics, which I call, well, this is used by everybody nowadays, but I think we were some of the first who used this word, kind of quantum geometry. So I'll show to you how, in this framework of some of our histories, you can really sum geometry. You can talk about geometries in various ways, and the quantum aspects of them, because you talk about ensembles of geometries. And this will also lead to the appearance of what we call causal dynamical triangulations. Then I will turn to a new interesting topic, namely how to get deep brains out from the world sheet point of view. So deep brains are, of course, important in kind of string theories. But in the context of world sheet, that is two-dimensional quantum gravity, they appear in a very natural way here, and simply by fine-tuning some boundary cosmological constants. And I'll describe to you how this appears and how you can see a transition from, say, compact geometry to non-compact geometry, the non-compact geometry being described by the deep brains. This part of the lectures, this is the part which we know works, because we know that there are underlying continuum theories which are well-defined, and this is a kind of lattice regularization of this. The amazing thing about this lattice regularization is that it turns out to actually, contrary to what is usually the case with lattice theories, it turns out to be a powerful tool to actually calculate analytically things which are difficult to calculate in the continuum formalism. But nevertheless, I mean, all the results which can be calculated in the continuum formalism agrees with what we can calculate here, but we can calculate more objects here. We can address more objects than we can do in the continuum formalism. And I will explain to you why. But of course, two dimension is not really where we want to be. I'll then describe a little bit what happens in higher dimensions. We don't have such a rich theory because we don't have many analytical tools. I will discuss a little bit the matrix models in higher dimensions, and I put a question mark here because, well, at least the matrix models I consider seems kind of useless in higher dimensions for actually extracting any interesting physics. This leaves us with kind of numerical simulations as a possible tool, like in ordinary lattice gauge theories in QCD. And I'll describe for you why some of these Euclidean versions, they seemingly fail, and some apparently are successful, like this theory which I mentioned before, called causal dynamical triangulations. So this causal dynamical triangulation is you impose some kind of restriction on the possible triangulations which are allowed. It seems that if you allow any triangulation in Euclidean space, things become kind of too wild, and you don't really get a continuum limit, at least not one you want. So this is the outline of the lectures. So let me start with the point particle. It's kind of trivial, so I apologize a little bit, but still maybe it will be in a different perspective than you used to see the quantization of the point particle. And as I said, it actually contains everything. So once if you understood this, the rest of the lectures will be a piece of cake. So let us start with a point particle, and let us choose as a classical action one of the standard classical actions which are chosen for the relativistic point particle, namely the mass times the length of the path. And well, I rotate immediately to Euclidean space here, so I'll work in Euclidean space. And you calculate the propagator, then you can get back to Mikoskin space by rotating. So I'll work in Euclidean space. So to derive the classical equations of motion for such an object here, so this is formulated in terms of geometry, because it's basically just saying that the action is the mass times the length of the path. So it's entirely geometric if you choose this particular action. Now, to derive the classical equations of motion, you have to choose a parametrization of this. So we are facing here the usual problem of general relativity, that really we don't want to use coordinates, but we don't know how to address it without choosing some coordinates, at least sometimes. So let's choose a parametrization of the line from 0 to 1, map it into RD, such that at 0, it's the start point, and at 1, it's the end point of this particular path. And then the classical action becomes this thing here, and we can derive the equations of motion. So they are just the equation of motion just given here. So an obvious solution is that the derivative is a constant here. In fact, equal to the difference between the two endpoints of the path. So just the particle moving in a straight line between these. But of course, this is just one choice of parametrization. Any reparametrization will can lead to the same path, just traveled intrinsically in this fictitious parameter xi with different speeds. So the only requirement here is usually that f dot is larger than zero. So well, you could say that this is a reparametrization of the interval from 0 to 1. Of course, the path itself, the physical path, is totally insensitive to this so-called invariance. I mean, whatever you would like to call it. And physics shouldn't depend on this choice at all. And of course, quantizing these reparametrization invariant theories are usually a pain, because we choose a parametrization and then we fight to get rid of it. But I will show you now how, in this context here, you can forget about all these details and you still get the right result. So this is a kind of geometric quantization. So the propagator is usually, well, so it's described as a path integral over all possible paths going from x to y, and with the weight given by your classical action. Well, that's a useful description of it. However, we should somehow define what we mean by the path integral here. And for that purpose, let's introduce a geometric cutoff A. So we insist that this cutoff has nothing to do with the chiral-representation of the line. It's a really geometric cutoff. So it's so one way of doing that, choosing such a cutoff, is to choose a building block, a geometric building block. So I've drawn one here. It has length A and it has a direction here in physical space, pointing there. And then, as my path, I will choose a set of paths. I mean, there are many paths. This is a little subset of it. Of course, these are piecewise linear paths going from x to y, which I can build up from these building blocks here. So I just add them. So here's an example where n is equal to 10. And of course, even for this n equal to 10, of course, these are allowed to points are allowed to vary in all possible ways, consistent with the fact that the path goes from here to here. So the action itself, this is simply equal to m0 times the length of the path, which is the number of building blocks you put in, times the length of each building block. So there are many other paths. The idea is that this set of paths is sufficiently dense in the set of all paths that when we take A to 0, it will produce for us the correct result. So this means that our path integral here with this A now reduces a sum over all possible number of building blocks we can insert so some of them might not be kind of realized. I mean, if for example, this is a real situation, then of course, n equal to 1 will not be realized because we have this constraint that the sum of these should be equal to this thing here. But for sufficiently large n, we can reach from here to here, and then we can take n arbitrarily large, and the pass can be equal as it likes. So the sum of a pass is simply replaced by this sum here and this integral over all possible kind of directions. The only constraint being that the sum of the pass goes from x to y.
So the EI is simply the
unit direction of the individual space. So
that's
the EI where I forgot to put a hat. Yes, sorry. Yes, I put a hat. So we can say that the pass integral is defined on a class of piecewise linear paths going from x to y. I will discuss other choices later, but this is definitely one choice one can make. Yeah. Yeah.
So in what sense this vector is unit? Because how do you compare lengths of two vectors into different points?
Well, it's a unit vector in RD. There's no background matrix. This is flat space. No. This is explicitly cardiometric invariant. I mean, I have a pass going from x to y. It's made out of building blocks. They have a length. Each building block. This length is, of course, independent of any parametrization you could take of the pass because it's the actual length in target space.
Is E normalized in any sense?
E is a unit vector, a vector of unit lengths.
What does it mean, length
A? Well, I have RD.
Okay, and vector on flat.
Yeah, and I choose my units to be centimeters. You want to know what it is? Then I say this unit vector is a vector pointing in a certain direction, RD, of length 1 in centimeters.
Okay.
But now I want a small one, so I multiply it by a factor A. So it becomes 1 millimeter, you know. or even less, you know. So that's exactly what I mean. That is why I call this kind of geometric quantization, because it doesn't use any parametrization or anything. It just uses the objects themselves as invariant geometric objects. Well, I don't know what you call a background geometry here. I'm just in flat space.
This question is whether you could generalize that to any kind of target space.
Well, I probably can, but personally, I have no interest in doing that. So let's not do it now. I will later discuss something which is maybe more similar to what you're asking as an example. So the pass integral now, simply becomes this sum here. The action is just here; it's just the number of units, and we now integrate our all positions. So now I will not do many explicit calculations, but let's just do one explicit calculation here. So let's calculate this to the very end, so to speak. So in order to perform this integral, it's nice to get rid of the delta function. We can do that by a Fourier transformation. So we discuss the Fourier transform of the Green's function, and then you see the delta function goes away, and the integral just becomes a product here of a d-dimensional integral over this unit vector, and this integral itself can be performed explicitly. So it becomes some Bessel functions here. Let's put it off here. So. It becomes some Bessel functions. Let us just call this f of pa. So it depends on the momentum, and this lattice length of our building blocks. So the only thing that we need here is that this function has the following characteristic, that for p equal to 0, it's some value, positive value different from 0. In fact, it's a volume, clearly, it's the volume of the d minus 1 sphere, because this term is not there if p is equal to 0. I was forgotten a here, I see.
Excuse me,
yeah.
I was thinking about the other length because we can see behind this column.
Ah, okay, I didn't notice that, yeah. So you want it here?
Yeah.
Yes, okay, fine. I'm sorry, yeah. Sorry, it just seems that I've got an A here. Let's put that in here. So the only thing we need is that now when we power expand this, because eventually we want to take A to be small, we want to shrink these building blocks to the side, then it starts out with a P squared plus higher powers here. But now you see that it becomes a simple geometric series, because these guys, they factorize, and we can perform the summation explicitly here. Now, how do we get a continuum propagator kind of from this when A goes to 0? Well, what we need is to perform a mass renormalization. So we had put in here in Lagrangian what we now want to call a bare mass. And I now want to renormalize this mass and get to a physical mass. So if I define the physical mass in this way here, then you see that this factor here becomes 1 minus c squared times this plus higher kind of corrections in A. And I'm doing this in order that I will cancel here this factor 1, and this can be replaced by 1 to the lowest order in A squared, and I will just get m squared plus p squared here times 1 over A here. So this is exactly the kind of mass renormalization which is needed in order to recover the continuum physics. So what we can say here, get to the right side here. So what we can say is that the lattice or the regularized propagator when A goes to 0 goes to 1 over A squared times this thing here plus higher order corrections in A, which will vanish. So we have a relation like this. And this is always what you find. Also, if you take a hypercubic lattice and so on, you always find and free field theory, you will always find that the lattice regularized propagator, which is defined to be dimensionless in some sense, I mean, ends up by being this, where you have a power here of 1 over a squared. So you see that this regularization painlessly can reproduce the correct result, which we want for the free particle. And it's worth to, let me rephrase these results in dimensionless kind of variables from the very beginning, because this is how we will usually work. So let me introduce not the bare mass, but a dimensionless quantity. I multiply by this lattice cutoff A, and similar, the momentum becomes kind of dimensionless here. And then my Green's function becomes sum here. So you see that this mass term here, this bare mass term, it acts in a way like a chemical potential, a fugacity for insertions of additional building blocks in the random walk. Because the smaller this value is, the more likely it is that large n will kind of dominate. So when this becomes smaller and smaller, in every cell will be more and more pieces of this n is the number of building blocks which are in the random walk. And in fact, there is even a critical value here of this fugacity. In fact, you can see it from here. So this function f is a decreasing function starting at maximum at 0. And you can see that the critical value of mu is simply the log of this thing here, such that when mu is larger than mu critical, then this sum is convergent. And when mu is less than mu critical, then the sum is divergent. And the continuum limit, which we just found, is defined by approaching this critical point. So we come from above with mu, and we approach the critical point. And any dimensionful parameter we define in the theory is defined by the way we approach the critical point. So this is a completely general description in statistical physics of critical phenomena. You have a critical surface in general, depending on your various coupling constants. You have a critical surface. On this critical surface, the correlation length is infinite, so the correlator is massless. Coming from an arbitrary coupling constant, in general, your propagators will be massive. And if you think of a lattice in general, they will have a correlation length of a few lattice spacing. But now fine-tuning things to go to this critical surface, the way you approach it, the way that you cut into this surface will define your coupling constant, which has a dimension of mass. So that, depending on the theory, that could be one, two, or several such parameters. And the way you approach this critical surface define exactly these massive parameters. And this is exactly what happens here. So let us just, to be complete, let us go through the detail and see how it works. So we have the sum. It's the same sum as before, just written in dimensionless variables. And the function here can be written like this. And when we put this in here, what we get is a result like this. And now we define the mass by the approach of mu to mu critical. So this is supposed to be a constant which is left invariant when mu approach mu critical. But the lattice spacing then has to appear here because this is a dimensionless quantity. This we view as a real dimensionful quantity. And the only way we can compensate that is to invoke our cutoff, which is in this case the lattice spacing. So since this is constant, then you see that the vision here is that when we approach this point, we know that random paths with very many insertions are dominating. And therefore, we have to shrink the lattice spacing in this relation if you want a fixed physical length. And this relation here, coming from here, tells us exactly how to do it. So the lattice spacing should be shrunk as the square root of mu minus mu critical. If we do it like that, but only if we do it exactly like this, then we will get the propagator of the free particle. If you try to do something else, we will get something else. And in general, we will get some nonsense which has no continuum interpretation. Okay, so what I want now to emphasize for you is the concept of universality, because that will be dominating our description of this. So what I have said here, I took this particular action, which were just the length of the path, because this was very kind of geometric. But in fact, any reasonable weight here leads to the same continuum limit. So let me take an example here. Namely, now I don't write this action as a nice length sum, but I take some arbitrary function of the distance between two neighboring points in the discrete piecewise linear kind of random walk, and I put also such a term here, and then the action can be written in this way here, where f is just the exponential of this function here. So we now have a, so we now we don't have pieces of a random walk which has a given length. The length can be arbitrary depending on this weight here. So then the propagator becomes an expression like this. So you see that this is a convolution. And now from the central limit theorem, then we know that for n large, sufficiently large, then this convolution automatically goes to a Gaussian. So depending only on the endpoints here, so all the intermediate points are integrated out in convolution, becomes a Gaussian depending on the endpoints. This C is kind of related to the first moment of F, and sigma here is related to the second moment of this function. So for a very general class of functions, which has a first and second moment and some restrictions on the third moment, we know that the central limit theorem is valid. So for a large class of functions, we have something like that.
Sorry, yeah. Could you
I don't want to go into a detailed kind of discussion. I'm giving here some examples. So this is an example of an action. One which only depends on the difference between the two. So you see that this is like a derivative term, x minus y. So any slice function there would then be higher powers of this. So this would be higher first order derivative, so to speak, the first order derivative to higher powers and so on. You could also make it more general by having xi minus 2 xi minus 1 plus xi minus 2. Then you would have a second order derivative. Then these would thing would still somehow apply. You know, I'm just doing taking the path of least resistance here to present you some examples which can be easily addressed. But it's a very last class of actions. So you see that from a very last class of Fs, this is what happens. So we have this central limit theorem. And since we will eventually be interested in large n's because we want a situation where we have many of these sections, then to a good approximation, we can just insert this this expression in the propagator, and then we get an expression like this, where this mu critical is related to the first moment of the function f in this way. And we can make the Fourier transform as before, and we get something like this, and we end up precisely with the expression like we had before. And it has the same continuum limit. So you see that there's a huge class of functions which give the same. Another example of a slightly different nature, but which also reveals some interesting aspects. This is if we choose, so here I was in the continuum and had a continuum number of kind of random paths, but now let me instead use piecewise linear random walks on a hypercubic lattice. So here I still have the concept of building blocks of a certain length, namely equal to the lattice spacing here. But of course, it's a different selection of piecewise linear walks than I had before when I had was in the continuum and used these building blocks. There they could wiggle in all possible ways. Here, they are less they're much more restrictive because they have to follow the lattice spacing. But again, one can solve these models explicitly if you use this action, I mean the length of the path, and one can show that it's the same continuum limit. So you see that it is very universal, and that's of course the basic concept of critical phenomena and Euclidean quantum field theory, that the continuum limit of many discretized actions is the same. I mean, there's of course a limit to how far you can push this, but there are often a kind of huge class of discretized action which will lead to the same thing.
Question?
Yeah.
If you take a path which goes like in a 45-degree angle to the hypercubic
lattice,
with respect to this
lattice,
there's always this curve of 2 times.
Yeah.
So how do you get rid of it?
Tell you in a second. So because this hypercubic lattice is good for addressing a certain number of questions. So first of all, the question of entropy. So it's clear that these random walks on the lattice, they have a certain entropy. You can ask how many random paths can I have on the lattice of a given length. In the continuum, the first model we considered, you could also try to ask this question, but of course we have infinite many because we could vary it continuously. So on the hypercubic lattice, it becomes kind of clearer. So the propagator is again defined by the sum of all paths going from x to y, where these are two lattice points. And we now write it as a sum over n, and then all paths on the lattice of length n going from x to y with a weight n. So this is simply, this is the number of paths going from x to y on the lattice. So the propagator can be written kind of like this. And now it turns out, I'm not going to prove this for you, but it turns out that this number here, it grows exponentially in a well-defined way times a function which is not growing exponentially in n. In fact, it's falling off in n. And it's also a function of x and y. But this exponential growth here So this vector comes in. Well, so if you, let's first view kind of random walks, which have no, which starts out in one point, but where we do not specify the endpoint. So we say it has links 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but it's allowed to end anywhere. So it can end here, it can end here, it can go here. It starts at a fixed point, but it can end anywhere. So this number of paths we can easily count, because if you are on a d-dimensional hypercubic lattice, we have two d directions to go at each step, namely this way, this way, this way, this way, etc. Well, I cannot point in other directions here, but if you want higher dimensions, it would be the same. So the total number of paths of length n, if we do not specify where it ends, goes like 2 to the d to the n power. So you see that if that was the answer, then this critical point would be d times log 2. And that is, in fact, the correct answer. So this function contains a subleading contribution coming from the fact that we demand that the path should not end arbitrary, but should end in one specific point. But this is a subleading contribution. It will not contribute. So you see that the propagator can be written kind of like this. And since this is a slowly varying function, we have the same phenomena as before, that when mu is larger than this mu critical, which is coming entirely from the entropy of the random walks, the exponential growth of the number of kind of random walks, when we approach there, we have a continuum limit. So in principle, this is a counting problem to count this number here. And you see that the calculation of the propagator is reduced to pure counting. And this is the thing we will see again and again.
Sorry. Yeah?
Well, everything is explicit invariant, because I'm only considering a geometric object, so I never need to make any parametrization of this.
So you gauge fixing?
No, there's no gauge fixing. Why do you call it? I'm summing over geometric objects, yeah. And the action is the length of the path, which is described entirely in terms of geometry. About what?
About the fact that the continuum action you're trying to produce is a parametrization.
No,
so
no.
If it was not,
well, there would be many, many other actions which leads to the same result. The philosophy is the other one, that usually it requires some pain to quantize in continuum framework, to quantize actions which are representation invariants, because what do you have to do? You first have to gauge fix, you first have to do this and this and this. Unless you can work with geometric objects, then you don't have to gauge fix, clearly. Because all the gauge fixing is exactly done in order to work with geometric objects. Now here, I'm telling you there are a number of situations where you can work entirely with geometric objects. So you are, in a way, performing your path integral, and I don't care how you're doing it. You're doing it correctly because you're summing over all geometries. You're only summing over a subclass, of course, because there are many other paths going from x to y. Now you're constraining yourself to a hypercubic lattice. Before, I was constraining myself to some other piecewise linear selection of paths. But what I'm saying is that this is sufficiently dense in the set of paths to give me the right thing. So now let me address this question that Thomas asked. So what Thomas said was, look here, if you take a diagonal on the lattice, then there is no lattice path where the action of this lattice path is, if you take the action to be the length of it, where the action approaches the corresponding continuum one. Because if the length here is L, then kind of no matter how small my lattice spacing is, then the minimal length I can have for a lattice path is the square root of 2 times L. So in no way I have any lattice paths which are close to this in terms of the action. But the point here is that to judge whether a path in the set of path integrals which appear in the measure of the path integral is close to another path, to judge this, I mean, the action is actually not the relevant thing to do. You have to define a measure on your set of paths. You have to find a norm in the set of paths, and that norm should be in accordance with your measure that you use in the path integral. And it is in this measure that you should judge if two paths are close to each other. So it turns out on the hypercubic lattice, or even in the continuum, there is such a measure, or such a norm corresponding to the Wiener measure. Namely, if you have two paths, P1 and P2, then you can define it as first you take you fix one point on one path, and then you take the minimum distance of all other points to this point, and then you take the maximum when you vary this point. If you use this norm as a measure of the distance between two paths, then it's clear that the distance is simply given by this thing here. So finer you take the lattice spacing, the closer the two paths becomes in the norm defined on the space of paths. What this illustrates is that the eventual continuum, this is also well known from the theory of critical phenomena, that the continuum result you end up with in the end is very insensitive to the action. We know it from the real world when we look at magnetized systems. They can be vastly different in the lattice, but nevertheless the critical exponents, which I will talk about later also, are the same for these. So the continuum physics are sort of same, no matter what you kind of start out with. And often there is no continuum interpretation of these actions, but nevertheless in the end, close to the critical point, you get a continuum field theory coming up. So the third example, let us have a break in 2 minutes. 2 minutes. Yeah. The third example is maybe what Laurent is a little bit after. So this is actually a special case of example one, namely kind of one-dimensional gravity coupled to matter. So you can write down another action for your scalar field x mu, a Gaussian field, which depends on the intrinsic metric of the world line. So of course, from the point of view of target space, this is an auxiliary variable, but it has this nice feature, and that's why it has been used a lot, namely that the action is Gaussian in x, and you get the same classical equations as you get for the if you take the length, which is also a representation invariant. If you take the variation both with respect to the metric and with respect to x. Now, in this case, your path integral would be more complicated. It would be the integral over all possible choice of metrics, which are basically in this fundamental case all parametrizations, and then the integral over x in this way. So now let us again do this one more time. Let us introduce a representation invariant cutoff, namely a cutoff A in the intrinsic space, which is a real physical cutoff. It really gives the intrinsic length of this. So we write down the A like this. So A becomes, now we are in one dimension, so there's only one index, 1, 1. So A becomes kind of like this. And the total length is, of course, a representation invariant. So we chop the total length up in n pieces here. Of course, if you had chosen a parameterization, then there is a corresponding choice of coordinates here, namely such that when we come to number k of these n pieces, we have a certain choice of coordinates. And then the difference here becomes approximately equal to this. So we are kind of we are realizing this. Yes. No. Let me put them up here. Yes. So I'm just saying that we chop the interval in kind of such pieces here, so that each has an intrinsic proper length of A. So now to discretize this system, we view the intrinsic geometry as piecewise linear. In this case, there is no structure really in the intrinsic geometry, but we still can insist that it is piecewise linear, consisting of something which is not changing in these constant, where the metric is not changing on these constant pieces. So this is made of, again, identical intrinsic building blocks of length A. And then So the only slightly non-trivial remark in this case is that now when we look at the matter fields, we insist that they have a similar discretization. Because if you really think of this as a matter field interacting with living on the line and being representation invariant action, then this matter field should only change according to the real length of the line. I mean, whatever parameterization we choose should be it shouldn't care. I mean, in the real physical value of x, it shouldn't care. So we make a corresponding discretization of x, saying that it's constant on these intervals here. So for different parameterizations, these intervals can vary randomly, but we still say that the x itself is constant on these intervals. So in terms of physical length of the intrinsic line, it is like that. And then, of course, with this choice, we can put it into our diffeomorphism invariant action, and we get a sum like this. And now the integration over possible representation becomes a sum over n. This integration becomes a sum over xi, and we obtain a result which is similar to the one we have already seen in a more general setting. Only here the action from the very beginning is Gaussian. In the other case, we saw that we could start out with almost any action and we end up with a Gaussian one. Here, from the very beginning, it is Gaussian. And we have this thing here, we take the continuum limit and we get the same result as before. So I would say that this random walk contains all the philosophy which will be in the next lectures. So this is a good point to stop. Okay, thank you. Well, in fact, what you usually get is the kernel of the propagator, of course. Because you get the kernel, you get the propagator by integrating over the proper time of the kernel. So you get generally the kernel, but it's not the propagator. Okay. Well, the bare mass, it's like in all quantum field theory. I mean, the bare couplings have no significance as such. I mean, only the renormalized masses are the ones which have a...
Yeah, if I were to use it this way to define my theory...
But this is what you also do in conventional field theory. I mean, think about it. I mean, you have the mass of whatever pion or whatever you want to describe. I mean, you have to renormalize your theory. Your mass is infinite because of the counter terms, but then you adjust it, the leftover, the renormalized mass, you adjust it such that it exactly fits your observation. But the bare mass plays no role. So it's exactly the same. Okay.